The Writer's Voice. To celebrate our 30 years of service, Virginia Voice's Patty Campbell talks to noted writers about their lives and work. The Writer's Voice on The Virginia Voice.
I'm your host for these programs, Patty Campbell, and today we have Times-Dispatch sports columnist Paul Woody with us. Paul, it's wonderful to have you here.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not really a celebrity. I'm just an old sports writer, but it's nice to be called a celebrity.
Oh, we think you're a celebrity. Okay. Let me start by asking you why you think sports are so important.
People attach themselves to teams. And it's always fascinating to me, particularly now at the professional level, when the composition of teams change almost yearly. People still remain loyal to that uniform, like the Washington Redskins or the New York Giants or the New York Yankees or Boston Red Sox. It doesn't really matter who the players are. It's that they're in that Red Sox or Yankees or Redskins uniform. That's important to them. It gives them some type of connection. What I've noticed is that at the high school level, parents really enjoy watching their children compete and gaining from the various lessons they might learn from sports. Now, some parents go overboard, and it's not as much fun to be around them. But for the most part, that whole scene is really quite enjoyable. I think everybody thinks that's fun and important.
Now, are you a sports writer and a sports columnist because you're a big sports fan?
Well, I'm a sports fan, and years ago when I was in college trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life, it was like a great epiphany. I was umpiring a little Major League Baseball game, which I did not think was going to be my future and did not want that to be my future. And I said, what do I like? Well, I like sports, and I like to write. Let's try being a sports writer.
Now you have the column. How long have you been writing the column?
Well, I've been doing the column full-time only since last October. But I was I did like a part-time columnist, two a week, since about 1990.
And have you been with the Times-Dispatch all of that time?
I began with the News Leader, which was the afternoon paper here in town. And then the News Leader and the Times-Dispatch merged in 1992, and we all became Times-Dispatch people. And it's kind of interesting. Those of us who started out with the News Leader, like I started there in December of 79, I've now worked longer for the Times-Dispatch than I did for the News Leader, but you're still a News Leader person for some reason, so that's kind of interesting.
And always in sports.
Yes.
Always in sports.
Now, I've written things for many other sections of the paper, but my primary responsibilities have been in sports.
And we're interested in what you've brought to read for us here today. Is everything from the sports section?
No. In fact, some of my favorite pieces are from different sections.
Can we hear some of that?
I would be happy to.
Okay. Tell us about what you're going to read.
This is a piece I wrote soon after my father died. And we had a section called the writer's block. And everybody was free to contribute columns to that section. And I'd like to do that, so I would contribute whenever I could, whenever I had time. And some of these are from that writer's block.
So that section's not there anymore, is it?
No, that went away a while ago. We have so much to do and not as many people as we used to have. So it's now sort of a challenge just to get your responsibilities taken care of.
People are pretty much sticking to their beat.
Very much so, yeah.
Well, let's hear what you wrote for the writer's block.
Well, this was written on December 5th, 2005. And the headline on it was, Writer Has Strange Encounter of the Meaningful Kind. I had gone for 47 years and not seen a man who closely resembled my father. Then, 2 weeks after my father died, I saw a man who could have been his double. It was the strangest sensation. I was standing in the bank when a red SUV pulled up to the drive-through window, and sitting in the driver's seat was a man who looked so much like my father, I felt butterflies in my stomach. I practically smiled. I wanted to call out to everyone in the bank, "That man looks just like my father." Somehow, I didn't think they would completely share my joy. I didn't think they would grasp the significance that this man resembles a man who had been cremated 2 weeks earlier. I didn't think they'd understand how much this meant to me. I wanted to rush out of the bank, stop the SUV before it got out of the parking lot, and ask the man all the questions I had for my father. But I, A, didn't figure this complete stranger would appreciate being stopped by a lunatic in the bank parking lot, and B, knew he couldn't answer my questions. I did have a lot of overwhelming questions. Mostly it was the mundane stuff, such as, why did you have so many accounts at so many banks? Did we find all the money? Mom's going to need it. By the way, how did you manage to save all that money? Any tips you have will be appreciated. Then I would have moved on to the more difficult question. How is it you were in such good health for so long? Then a month after we last saw you, you're in the hospital dying. Of course, I knew the answer to that one. Leukemia. Chronic myelogenous leukemia. I think about my father often, but not in ways you might suspect. I don't mope around thinking, I wish I'd said this to him. I wish I'd told him I loved him more often. My father was a man of few words, and so am I, all evidence to the contrary. I think my father knew how he felt about him. I'm certain I know how he felt about me. When I think of my father, I'm perplexed, puzzled, and sometimes even angry that a man who was in such good health was felled by this one, ultimately unsolvable problem. I didn't find that fair at all. Life is the oddest of propositions. Most days, I don't know quite what to make of it. I miss my father. He's been gone 5 years, and there still are times when I'll be driving home and I'll shake my head and say, damn, how did that happen? I just miss knowing he's there. I miss pulling up in front of my parents' house and seeing the huge console television with its screen glowing so brightly you could see it from a block away. I miss walking in the house and seeing him in his chair. I miss the way my wife could make him laugh. I miss the idea that he knows what I'm doing, what his grandsons are doing, and is immensely proud of all of us. Maybe he knows all that. I can't say for sure, and I'm not sure I want him to know everything because I don't think he'd be thrilled that his wife of 57 years spent the last 5 years of her life in a nursing home. We'd go around a few times on that one. We probably should have gone around on it a few times while he was alive. As for my father's body double, I've seen him a couple of times since that first sighting. I pointed him out to my wife once, and she said, "He doesn't look like your father. Your father was much more handsome than that." Honestly. How can a woman be so lovely and so smart and miss something so obvious? Then again, maybe she didn't need to see the resemblance as much as I did.
That's a lovely piece, Paul. I'm always fascinated when someone writes something like that for publication in the newspaper. And I'm curious about why. Is it something that you wanted to share with your readers? Is it something that helped you to deal with the loss of your father?
It's interesting. Sometimes I'm not sure that you know why, except that what you do is write, and you have these experiences, and you have these ideas, and you write them. And what happened afterwards, for this one and several other pieces similar to it, I got a lot of emails and calls saying, from people saying that they'd had similar experiences and that somehow this had helped them with get through that. So that's very rewarding.
That shared common human experience.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So that was nice. And you always wonder, though, you know, is this too personal? Is this too much of my ego out there that I want to have to write this down and let the world see it? Maybe I should just keep it to myself. But ultimately what we do with the newspaper is we write stories and put them out there and let people read them and tell us what they think.
And, let's hear another one.
Okay. Well, this one is about, this was in the sports section, March 2nd, 1995. And we have three boys. Now they're 29, 26 and 19, and this is about something that happened between the 29 and the 26-year-old when they were much younger. So the headline on this one is, "Some winners start by losing to brothers." He storms into the house, slams the door, and yells, "Cheater!" And the problem is, "Nothing," he yells, now near tears. "Life's good then. Whenever I get ahead, he changes the rules," he says. He's so mad he can't stand still. Who is the cause of all this rage? His big brother, of course. A few minutes later, in walks the usual suspect. He's cool, calm, collected, seemingly unaware of the cyclone of anger he helped create. "What's up?" he says. "We were discussing that. Your name came up." "Me? What did I do?" he says, managing to look innocent and smug all at once. A job description for older brothers would read something like this. Must be domineering, at times even a bully. Must be able to say with a straight face and a touch of haughtiness in his voice, "I was just trying to help the little squirt. Too bad he's not smart enough to appreciate it." "I used to always play with my older brother," said Daryl Oliver, 18 and a freshman guard on the University of Richmond basketball team. "It was kind of wild. Most of the time I couldn't score because they were so much bigger than me. And they didn't take any pity on me. They'd block my shots, they'd steal the ball." Oliver's brother, Anthony, 24, played basketball for Virginia. His brother, Purnell, 20, plays middle linebacker for Catawba College. On almost every college team, you'll find someone's little brother, and invariably, that little brother would tell you how his big brother used to beat the daylights out of him in every game, and how much that has helped him now. "There were plenty of times when I get so mad, I'd punt the basketball and just give up and go in the house," said Kurt Axe, Randolph Macon's point guard. "But he'd make me come out again, so he could beat up on me some more. But he never let me back down." At least Axe's brother, Ryan, who was 3 years ahead of Kurt in school, let Axe get away. "I never got a chance to get inside," Oliver said. "They wouldn't let me. They knew my mother would be upset." But about all parents can do in these sibling situations is make sure blunt objects are kept out of reach of everyone involved, and offer this advice. Either quit playing with your big brother or get used to it. Eventually, things will even out. It requires patience. "It wasn't until my junior year in high school," Oliver said of his day of reckoning with Purnell. "Axe was a junior or senior in high school before he pulled even with his brother." "I'm glad I went through that," Axe said. "It's not something you think about at the time, but competitively and with my skills, it helped me as much as anything. I had the opportunity to watch him go through things before I had to go through them. He helped me learn all the things I needed to know. Even now, when I have a question about anything, he's one of the people I go to right away. That's not hard to understand." Several hours after that driveway Donnybrook, the younger brother who had been so outraged was in his room, playing basketball on the goal stationed in front of his closet, with his big brother. They shook the house with their jumping, shouted "jam" with each shot, talked and laughed. They told each other things they rarely consider sharing with their parents. You might not convince them of this when they're locked in combat on the driveway basketball court, but they're lucky to have one another.
Now, you said that was not one of your columns, or was one of your
columns?
Yes,
that was a sports column.
It was interesting to me how you took what was going on at your house and went to sports figures and found out what was going on with them. Do you get inspiration? Well, where does the inspiration for your columns come from?
Well, that's interesting. If you were to talk to my wife, she would say, "You never stop thinking about writing for that newspaper." And so you pretty much are always looking for ideas, for stories, for whatever. And almost from the time you wake up until the time you go to bed, you're listening to things on the radio or something on TV that might just be a kernel of an idea. You read the Times-Dispatch. I look at other newspapers, and I'm not always looking at the big, huge stories. Sometimes it's just a little thing that's on, you know, page C6 of the section or something, and it's two paragraphs. But
does that feel like pressure, or does that indicate that you really love what you do?
I think it indicates you love what you do.
Well, we love what you write.
Well, thank you. The pressure comes when you walk into the office, and it's a writing day, and you don't seem to have any ideas. Boy, that feels like a little bit of stress. But
what do?
You sit down and you take a deep breath and you say, "Well, I've been through this before, and I always came up with an idea. So at some point soon, I'll have an idea." And you look through the wires, or you look through the paper, or you just sort of sometimes keep a file of ideas for just such times, and you look at that and say, be a good day to bring that one out and work on that. So you do those kinds of things. And sometimes an editor walks up to you and says, need something on this. Or what happens more frequently these days, it seems, something happens. For instance, I left the office Monday knowing I had to come in and write Tuesday. And I really didn't have a real good idea of what I might write. But between that time and Tuesday, Denny Hamlin won a race in Pocono, and he's a local guy, and the University of Florida gave their football coach a $4 million a year contract. So I thought, huh, you know, the column gods are smiling on me now because I've got two ideas. So more ideas are better than none.
Can we hear some more?
Yes, and this is another one of those pieces that was a writer's block piece. Written on January 15, 2006, and the title of it is A Night Alone with the Wife and Shredder. I have always been jealous of those sitcom families who live in New York City in their spacious four-bedroom apartments. You know the type. The father is always a selfless public servant, a teacher or a producer for public television, and the mother is a struggling entrepreneur, trying to make a go of it in the party planning business or the catering business or as a one-woman public relations firm. They have two or three kids, might be a blended family, and they're just trying to make the best of each day. And each evening, Dad walks through the front door with bags of Chinese takeout in his hands. Their combined income appears to be just above the poverty level, yet they have this beautiful airy apartment in Manhattan and never lack for a good meal that has been prepared by someone else. I watch those shows and wonder where my wife and I went wrong. It's not the apartment I covet. It's all those meals prepared by someone else. And then something happens that makes me think that maybe we haven't gone that far wrong. We have three sons, and two of them, as my wife says, are launched. That leaves a 16-year-old here on a full-time basis, and much to his chagrin, he now receives our full attention. He probably thinks there are better ways to go through his teenage years, and I can't blame him for that. One night, not so long ago, he was out for the evening, and we had an empty nest. My wife and I discussed going out to dinner, going to a movie, or just giving up and going to bed early. What we did was drop off our son, then return home to work on the project my wife had begun earlier that day, shredding old checks. They had to be disposed of in this manner, my wife said, because our Social Security numbers were on them. Yes, these were old, old checks. So we sat in the kitchen, our economy model shredder positioned over the trash can with my wife feeding check after check into the machine. Not too long into this, I was able to feel a kinship with the sitcom families and their endless supply of Chinese takeout. We discovered we had invested a considerable sum of money in a restaurant named Chinatown Wing Wang. Neither of us could remember where the restaurant had been, which was strange because you'd think you'd remember a restaurant with that name, especially since we'd written a small forest's worth of checks to Chinatown Wing Wang. Was it the one next to the pizza place during that period of time when we'd get pizza for the boys and chicken and broccoli for ourselves? Maybe, but there should have been an equal number of checks made out at the pizza place, and there were none. Some mysteries are not meant to be solved, I guess. This might not sound very much like a romantic, dynamic, or exciting way to spend a rare evening alone, but I have to tell you, it wasn't all that bad. We're not ready to be full-time empty nesters yet, but an occasional night spent exclusively in each other's company is not a bad thing at all. And besides, every journey must begin with the first step, and the first step to cleaning out the bookcase in the dining room had begun with getting rid of checks, some of them which were written in 1991. Yours or mine, my wife said, handing me a check. I don't recognize the name, I said. A doctor, she said. Mine, I think. A dermatologist. Look her up. I did. She was. For that thing on my arm, she said. Ah, that thing on her arm. What thing on her arm? Shouldn't I have known about that? Who in the world is more important to me than my wife? What kind of husband am I? We came across checks to our pediatrician and checks made out to companies with initials we did not recognize. We came across checks for shoes, and more shoes. Not our shoes, either. Basketball shoes, running shoes, soccer shoes, cotillion shoes. How many feet can three boys have, and how can they get so big so fast? We came across checks for after-school care when the big boys weren't so big. We found the check made out to the best pizza place in town. It was for $192, and it was for our oldest son's 18th birthday party. I'm no fan of writing big checks. To me, $192 is a big check, but I remember not even grimacing when I wrote that one. It was a good night. It was the last time my parents had come to visit us. They both looked good that night. Our son and his friends had a good time. And then my wife handed me several checks that were made out to different colleges, all for $25 or $35. "What were these for?" she said. I looked at them. We both were puzzled for a moment. Then it hit me. "Jake's college applications," I said. What we did that night was not so much shred checks. We had watched our boys grow up again. We relived a considerable portion of the life we spent together. That's not such a bad thing to do if your life together has been a good one. And ours has been good beyond description. "I'm going to bed," my wife said after clearing one more paper jam in the shredder. "Yeah," I said, looking at those checks to the colleges and wondering how it could be that our little blonde-haired boy now had two little boys of his own. "That's a good idea. There's only so much excitement you can stand in one night."
Nice piece. Do you miss the writer's block?
Yes, I miss it. Now that I'm doing the column full-time, I'm not sure how much time I would have to contribute pieces, but it's one of those things where you find the time. So, yeah, I do miss it, and it was nice to have. And we have a number of talented people on the staff who would be very good contributors to it, but it's one of those things.
Yeah. Well, we have about 5 minutes left together. Probably time for one more piece.
Okay. Let me read this piece. This is about Hal Nunley, who was the men's basketball coach at Randolph-Macon College. This was also in the sports section. It was written November 11, 2004. It's a eulogy, I guess you would say. He had died on November the 10th. And the headline is, "Buddha on the Bench. The Wisdom of Nunley Was Beyond Basketball." The longest message that can be left on our office voicemail system is 2 minutes. On Monday mornings, I have listened as the automated voicemail attendant said, "Two new messages. First message, received at 7:30 a.m., 2 minutes. I would then listen as Randolph-Macon basketball coach Hal Nunley offered his 2 minutes worth of commentary on the topic of my Sunday punch column. Often, it seemed, Coach Nunley and I disagreed. When those 2 minutes were up, I'd go to the second message, which was also 2 minutes long. And there would be Nunley again, continuing to either set me straight or elaborating on some bit of sports or history or sports history to illustrate the point he had begun during the first 2 minutes. And then there were the days when I was in the office, my phone would ring, I'd answer, "Sports, Woody," and a rich baritone voice on the other end would say slowly and precisely, "Paul Woody, Richmond's last living liberal." I would laugh and prepare for a few minutes of conservative or coaching wisdom from a man who had plenty of both. Hal Nunley died yesterday at the age of 65, and we are poorer for his passing. Nunley was the men's basketball coach at Randolph-Macon for 24 years. He won 431 games in that span, had 20 winning seasons and 10 seasons in which he won at least 20 games. Nunley was not just a coach. He was a repository of basketball knowledge, history, and philosophy. He imparted that wisdom to hundreds of players over the years. He taught them the finest points of the game. He demanded, cajoled, criticized, and praised them during practices, then sat almost Buddha-like during games and let them play. He demanded his players represent themselves, their families, their school, their team, and their teammates as gentlemen. He prepared countless assistant coaches to go on to bigger and better jobs. No, make that bigger jobs. Nunley never believed there was a better place to be than Randolph-Macon. He shared his basketball knowledge with anyone willing to ask. Nunley loved practically everything about coaching. He had a kidney removed, went through 2 heart bypass surgeries and 8 angioplasties, and kept coming back to coach. In the latter stages of his career, Nunley kept a bottle of nitroglycerin pills in his coat pocket during games for those moments when his angina became too intense to bear without medication. He left the profession only when his health no longer permitted him to do the job with the effort he felt was required to be successful. "Coaching spoils you to a degree," Nunley said in 1998. "I think if you can make a living doing something you enjoy, you're very fortunate. That's the way it has worked for me." The only thing Nunley might have loved more than coaching was Randolph-Macon College itself. In 1979, after a 9-17 season, the school gave him tenure. Nunley never forgot the commitment made to him and the trust showed in him after a losing season. When Division I schools called to ask if he would like to become an assistant or even a head coach, Nunley politely but firmly declined. Many go through life trying to figure out who they are and where they belong. Nunley had those questions answered soon after he began working as an assistant coach at Randolph-Macon in 1972. If there was one disappointment in his life, it was that his health forced him to give up coaching in 1999. His mind still was sharp. His knowledge of the game never diminished. His desire to coach never waned. Nunley's fire never went out. His heart just gave out. Yesterday, his heart gave out for the last time. Now, on Monday mornings, when I see the message light on my phone blinking, I'll know there is no possibility Coach Nunley will have called to enlighten this particular numbskull. I will miss that greatly.
I love Paul Woody, Richmond's last liberal.
Well, let's keep that to ourselves.
Paul, thank you very much for being with us today. This has been really special.
Patty, I'm flattered you asked, and it's just a tremendous honor for me to be here. So thank you.
Thank you. We've been talking with Paul Woody, Times-Dispatch sports columnist. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.
You've been listening to The Writer's Voice on The Virginia Voice.